Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. This spring, shed antler hunting is going to look a bit different. Wyomingites will be the only ones allowed to hunt for the first week.
So you could see just an expansion in activities by in-state residents.
Members of a comedy group in Jackson find community and laughter in the world of improv.
Being an adult can be kind of lonely, and so this is a great way to be silly.
And Wyoming Public Radio is taking part in an initiative to improve our reporting and help people be better informed about voting.
So that means we are helping public media stations to better engage with their communities, to be a public service journalism operation. So that's number one.
We'll learn more about the project, those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood. Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadalska. Shed hunting in Wyoming is going to look a little different this year. Residents have a one-week head start on some public lands, and that includes popular areas like Jackson Hole and Pinedale. Wyoming Public Radio's Olivia Weitz spoke with Sam Marr. She's a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley and the lead researcher on the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem Antler Study. The rule change came partly out of concern that out-of-state residents are trying to make a profit from antlers, and as a result, crowding out the locals. But Mara's survey results show a different story.
What did you find about who is the typical shed hunter? I'm wondering if you can paint a picture for us of who's going out and spending hours trying to find antlers in Wyoming.
Basically, the people who are doing this overlap a lot with people who are also hunting big game. So 90% of shed hunters are also hunters as well. And so it's this activity that you can do outside of the hunting season without a permit. You can do it in a lot of different areas that gets people outside. Demographically, what we saw in our survey results were that shed hunters were overwhelmingly white and overwhelmingly male. More than 85% were male, and nearly everyone who took the survey identified as white as well.
I'm curious, how many antlers are people finding when they're going shed hunting, and what exactly are they doing with the antlers after they find them?
It's highly variable how successful people are. And so part of this is because some people are going to put a lot more effort into it over the season. And there's also a really big element of luck as well. And so what we found was that the average number of antlers that were picked up by Wyoming residents was 20 per year, but out-of-state residents that were coming into Wyoming to shed hunt were picking up to 40 antlers a year. And so the reason for this is that a lot of the out-of-state shed hunters were coming and putting a lot more effort into going into feed grounds and areas where there were really high concentrations of antlers. And so what do people do with them? There's a couple of different uses. Pet chews has become a really popular industry for antlers. So those people who are selling antlers are often selling them to buyers and dealers that are going to saw them up for pet chews. Some people are using them for their own dogs themselves. But we found that more than anything else, people were just keeping them for decor. And so what this tells us is that people were really motivated just by the process of finding them, by the hunt itself, and a little less so for the uses. There's also a cohort of antlers that go overseas and are used for medicinal purposes in East Asia. South Korea is the biggest market for it there, but that's a relatively small use compared to people who are just keeping them personally for decor and for pet chews.
Interesting. I had no idea there were so many different uses. That's fascinating. Shed hunting in Wyoming is going to look different this year. The legislature passed a rule change where in areas of the state where there is a season, Wyomingites are going to get a week head start over non-state residents. And then those who are out of state will be required to pay to go shed hunting. I'm curious about what your survey says about how that rule change may impact the shed hunting season in Wyoming.
This will be really interesting to see what happens because one thing we found in the survey was that Wyoming residents had overwhelmingly changed their shed hunting behaviors and strategies to account for the fact that there was a lot of competition coming from outside of the state. So 93% of people had either shed hunted less or changed the locations where they did it. So when you take out this population, from out of the state, and they can't come in till 7 days after the season opens for in-state residents. It means that you might see people who had previously been avoiding feed grounds or previously avoiding certain sites or not going out right when the closures are lifted. Those people might be coming back in and kind of filling those gaps. So you could see just an expansion in activities by in-state residents.
There's some people out there saying that these rule changes came from the perception that lots of greedy out-of-state people are coming into Wyoming and taking up all the antlers. In your survey, you looked at people's motivations for why they antler hunt. What did you find?
Yeah, I'm glad you're asking this because I think this is one of the most interesting results that we saw is it kind of pushes back against this narrative that out-of-state folks just want to collect and sell antlers and make a buck. And so what we found is there was actually no difference between in-state and out-of-state people to the degree to which they are selling antlers. So 50% of in-state and 50% of out-of-state folks had sold antlers in the past, but overall, only 20% of antlers that people found were actually getting sold on. And so we found that profit-seeking behavior actually played a much smaller role than we originally thought it would, and it didn't seem to be distinguishing Wyoming residents from out-of-state folks.
As the sport in Wyoming has gotten more popular, has there been more conflicts between antler hunters and the state?
We found that about 40% of people had either had a conflict or knew someone who had a conflict, either with another shed hunter, with law enforcement, or with a landowner. But this can't tell us anything about whether or not those rates have increased over the years. You hear about it more, but that could just be that because shed hunting is becoming more popular, we're talking about it more frequently. They have been enforcing some of the laws around antler collection more than they had been in the past. They're known to track antlers to try to catch people who are picking them up outside of the season or in no-take areas. And then those people have been prosecuted and in a very public way. And so I think the hope there is that showing that yes, we are enforcing these rules is going to prevent those conflicts in the future. But I've also heard that there is a fair amount of conflict between shed hunters in areas where there are high concentrations of antlers, where there's a lot of people out there at the same time. You hear about people who will come into areas where antler removal is still illegal during the season closures, and they'll stockpile antlers and then come remove them after May 1st when you're legally allowed to take antlers out. And so people will come across these stockpiles and be like, hey, something's not right here. And I've heard stories about, armed confrontations over this, but that at this point is just hearsay.
And just looking back at the results, it seems like both Wyomingites and non-residents were also kind of shared similar some similar motivations for doing it. They like spending time outdoors, they like spending time with family. I guess, can you just talk about what sort of similarities out of state and in-state shed hunters had?
Yeah, absolutely. So it seemed that people really just like that shed hunting takes them outside. It gives them a mission. It brings them to places they might not go normally. And it's a way of interacting with the environment that's a little more active than if you just went hiking or something. And then there's, of course, like the thrill and the excitement of being able to find something as well. And so this is a way people, you know, they build communities around it. They do it with their children. They do it with their friends. They spend time in areas that they feel connected to. And so the benefits of shed hunting are really similar to the benefits of really any outdoor recreational activity. And it just has the fun element of you might be able to find something super cool that, you know, no one else has.
This is part one of a 2-year survey. These are the preliminary results of your study. You're going to give the survey out again this year. The rule change goes into effect in May. I'm just curious what you anticipate finding this year as the rule change goes into effect.
Right now, we're in the stages of trying to design a couple more questions to get at how people change their behavior as a result of the new laws. One of the things we're going to ask too is about enforcement. One of the big challenges of this is going to be enforcing the restrictions on out-of-state residents, especially during that 7-day head start period. And so we're going to ask people basically like, you know, have you encountered a warden in the field? Have you seen, you know, what have you seen? I know that's been one of the challenges that the agencies have said that is going to be difficult for them. We're interested, again, if we're going to see Wyoming residents coming out of the woodwork, people who hadn't been shed hunting in the last couple of years because of the craziness associated with it. Are we going to see them coming to big events like the Jackson opening? Or are we going to see, you know, a paring down of, you know, 1,000 people at the Jackson shed hunting opener to like, you know, 250 next year?
Well, Sam Marr is a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley, leading the Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem Antler Study. Thanks, Sam, for joining us.
Appreciate you having me.
Up next, a musician uses music to honor his Navajo ancestors lost in the Long Walk. This is Open Spaces.
I'm Caitlin Tan, and I grew up in Pinedale, Wyoming. And by about 10 years old, I came to love public radio. Wyoming Public Radio is the one public radio station for the state. And so Wyoming Public Radio really is the one thing that kind of unifies the whole state and makes us all feel like just one big community.
Do you love Wyoming Public Radio? Let us know at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state. Around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. A musician from our region is channeling his Navajo ancestors and drawing inspiration from an innovative composer to honor those lost in the Long Walk. KSUT's Clark Adamidis reports for the Mountain West News Bureau on a performance that will run for 4.5 years.
Delbert Anderson is a jazz musician and composer in Farmington, New Mexico. A few years ago, he was having dinner with a musician friend north of San Francisco.
And then he brought up John Cage and we talked about, you know, his famous piece, The Silent Piece. Was it 433?
433 is among the most famous works by 20th century composer John Cage. In the piece, musicians sit at concert rest, poised to play their instruments, but never doing so. As they waited for a table, Anderson and his friend riffed on John Cage's use of silence.
He started to say that there's this other piece, it's like 600 years long, and I thought, whoa, that's, you know, pretty cool. I never knew about that.
That Cage piece is called As Slow as Possible. And one German version is playing the series of notes over centuries with intermittent periods of silence lasting months. It's a performance that outlives the performers. These conversations inspired Anderson's own experiments with silence and time.
I want to do a piece that's long, but within someone's lifetime.
Recently, he launched a performance of a piece called The Long Walk. It's short compared to the Cage work that inspired it, a total of 50 notes played over 4.5 years. But where John Cage was focused on conceptual abstractions of sound and time, Anderson has woven cultural history into his composition.
Thanks for coming out. My name is Delbert Anderson.
In December, Anderson gathers with community members and musicians at an art gallery in Farmington. The performance tonight is a single note played for a 30-second interval, a concert D.
And those of you who want to participate, you're welcome to sing the note as well. You can hold the note as long as you want. Some people just do a simple bop, and that's it. And I'll talk.
Each note of the composition comes every month or two over 1,674 days. That's the length of time Navajo people were forced from their homeland in the 1860s by the U.S. government.
We thought it was just kind of a march, but they were well taken care of, and you know, they eventually got sent back home, so what's the big deal kind of thing. So when I started seeing how, like, you know, our ancestors were treated, it was mind-blowing.
In his research, Anderson learned Navajo people were malnourished and weren't clothed properly. They were forced to walk 450 miles to an internment camp in New Mexico. During some periods, 20 to 30 starved each week. These are the details performers and audience members consider in the moments before the note is played.
So, alrighty, let's go ahead and get ready. 1, 2, 3, and...
The musicians hold the D note, reflecting on an event more than 100 years old. Following the note, there's silence for some time.
Awesome. Yeah.
When I played that concert D on my trombone, I just felt echoes of like generations of ancestors.
Sam Botter is a trombonist and a native Hawaiian who lives in Farmington.
It was spiritually very grounding, and I think I really felt it in the silence after I played. I had to close my eyes and just kind of sit and think with it for a little bit.
The 50th and final note will be performed on June 1st, 2028. In the intervening time, several dozen additional notes will be played. Between them, there are periods of silence. Silence that reminds us of the deprivations and uncertainties Navajo people faced during their long walk. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Clark Adamitis.
Ghanaian-Canadian artist Iko Namako sculpts visions of the far future and the distant past, imagining what could be and what might have been in Black and African history. He crafts these visions out of Legos, inviting his audience to imagine along with him. Namako's 15-foot diptych sculpture, a Samondo, is now on display in the University of Wyoming's Visual Arts Building. The artist spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor.
I know you've probably gotten this question before, but I think we should start there anyway. Why choose Lego as a medium?
Well, I honestly have the most experience with Lego elements as a material. I experimented with different materials when I began focusing on sculpture as my primary artistic outlet. Prior to that, it was music, writing, and as far as visual art was concerned, drawing. But after art school and experiences in the sculpture studio, it became clear to me that I wanted to use three-dimensional form. So yeah, it was kind of like a no-brainer. The only missing component was knowing that I could use Lego elements as an artistic material and it would actually be recognized as that, you know, because prior to that, it's hobby stuff, it's, you know, geek culture, which I'm happy to participate in. But I hadn't seen contemporary artists using Lego. And then once I started grasping that and seeing examples of it from people around the world, then I knew it was really feasible.
I haven't gotten to see any of your work in person yet. I'm excited to see it when it's installed here. But something that stood out to me was that a lot of your work feels very fluid. How do you do that?
Well, you know, the funny and truthful answer is that I don't know how I do. Truly, it's an impulse, but I'm very interested in stripping away what I call the Lego-ness, the Lego elements and pieces. They have such an iconic presence in the world that it was important for me to try to strip away some of that iconography and just embrace it as this raw material. And while I still am using one source material, it is an extraordinarily varied medium. There's hundreds of thousands of different parts, most of which, in fact, people that don't have an affinity for Lego or use it regularly, they don't know about these parts. So often people question the materiality of my work when they encounter it because it's something they've never seen before. You know, in fact, I actually am I have an aversion to Lego bricks in that term, much to the chagrin of the Lego group, because that is like their trademark. So whenever I work with them, it's funny, they're always like, have to remind me. It's like, could you say Lego bricks? And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, I can say it for you. For me, I don't say Lego bricks because it's hard to find bricks in my work. You know, I don't expose the brick. I do use it as a foundation, but that's on the inside most times. I like to cover the bricks, not just because I'm trying to like disguise the brick, but because my aesthetic doesn't require the brick to be visible. I'm looking for the parts that are smooth and fluid and curved and angular, because things in nature don't occur on one angular plane, right? Like the petal of a flower, the curve of a person's cheek, it's not just one line curve, it's multiple curves interacting at the same time, creating something that is rounded.
Tell me about the subjects that you sculpt, and maybe we can start with the basics. What is Afrofuturism?
Afrofuturism is a movement, genre, a philosophy, a mode of thought that is interested in future landscapes, future ideologies, future narratives that center Black people in those stories. And I find it's also a vehicle for achieving change or liberation, even. Because when you operate from a place of being oppressed historically and in modernity, liberation is always at the forefront of your mind. When you see the kind of violence and disparity that is experienced so often by racialized people, then trying to overcome, trying to create a better world for your children, and by proxy, all children, it becomes extraordinarily significant. So Afrofuturism allows you to do that, because all movements of liberation started with some kind of future imagining, right? If you're not free, then you have to imagine yourself free in order to try and achieve that kind of freedom. And as well, it's important to highlight African futurism, which in many ways is much like Afrofuturism, but takes place typically on the continent of Africa and deals with decidedly African issues and African spirituality and things like that. Whereas Afrofuturism sprung up in the diaspora.
So something like Black Panther would be more African futurism than...
I would say actually more Afrofuturism, just because it's part of the Marvel universe. The Marvel universe, despite being global in many ways, is very American. Like, and that's why in the film, they even started it in Oakland. They rooted it in many ways in Oakland, despite the fact that, yes, it did take place in this fictional country in Africa. It still had its connection to the US and US culture. So it's kind of both, but I would say probably still more Afrofuturism. Whereas if you were to look at an author who coined the phrase African futurism, actually, her name is Nnedi Okorafor, award-winning novelist, creates extraordinarily beautiful works and complex characters, and her writing style is amazing. And she coined the phrase African futurism because she is a Nigerian American. She lives in America, but is Nigerian. And her stories take place not so much in America, but on the continent. So she felt it was necessary to have this African futurism term, which I also agree with. You know, I walked the line as well, where I was born in Canada, but both of my parents are Ghanaian and were raised in Ghana. So I grew up very much as a Ghanaian, but outside of Ghana. So I feel like Afrofuturism is something I gravitate to, but at the same time, in my soul, in my heart, African futurism is there as well.
So tell me about the work that's going on display.
The artwork that's going to be displayed at the University of Wyoming in their art department for 2 months is a piece called Asamando. And Asamando represents the afterlife in Akan mythology. And Asamando also represents the end of a journey that is illustrated in my body of work called Building Black Civilizations, Journey of 2000 Ships. And that is based off of a real life expedition that took place in the 14th century, the story of Mansa Abu Bakr II. So he was the intrepid ninth ruler of the Kingdom of Mali that decided he would abdicate his throne and have 2000 ships built and take those ships across the Atlantic Ocean. So these 2000 ships went across the ocean and disappeared. And there's some evidence that suggests they did make contact with the indigenous peoples of Central and South America. But any contact that doesn't necessarily support the Eurocentric vision of Christopher Columbus and all of that, or the transatlantic slave trade, isn't really highlighted historically and academically. So it was important for me to create these works. And even though a lot of the things I've built are speculative, they're not saying that this part of the journey 100% happened, but it could have happened. I think it's always kind of interested me, the things that happen in places that people don't often go. Deep sea travel or outer space travel, it's like plunging into the unknown. And just the fact that it's unknown just gives so much space for me to just have these musings and these like imaginative adventures and then create them so that people can also experience that same kind of wonder.
I feel like it's just fascinating to think about, I don't know, if contact had been established in earlier time or by other people. It's just interesting to think about what could have happened.
Right, exactly. And what probably did happen, right? But just not on the kind of scale or with the same kind of mercenary violence that sometimes excites people in the historical realms, right? It's like if there was contact, it was peaceful contact. It wasn't poisoned by violence and chattel slavery and exploitation and colonialism. It was about fostering solidarity and true scientific expedition.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to see your work in person. Thank you for talking with me today.
Yeah, absolutely.
An improv comedy group is holding a special performance to celebrate its 15th anniversary. That's up next on Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, our Facebook Live panel discussion on how to prepare for an urban wildfire. We talked to folks from the Burn Scar and the former mayor of Paradise, California.
In Paradise, what the fire didn't take was the sense of community that exists there. Our mission was, look how far we've come, and it was a vision to the future.
Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by the Argosy Foundation.
Join us for the newsroom from the BBC, and we'll bring you a fresh and lively look at what's happening in the world. Using our extensive network of correspondents, we take you to the story as it breaks. Get the facts and hear the experts on The Newsroom from the BBC.
Weeknights at 7 on Wyoming Public Radio, followed by Classical Wyoming from 8 to 11.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Kadalska. For the members of a comedy group in Jackson, improv is more than just something to do after work. It's a family, and it's taught them valuable lessons about connection, bravery, and the importance of a good laugh. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman takes us to a rehearsal before their big 15th anniversary celebration.
Oh, 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 you hear my pun. Who has more fun than me today?
On a Wednesday night in a church basement, nine members of the improv comedy troupe Laugh Staff dance in a circle as they practice a parody song. They're getting ready for their 15th anniversary show. Brian Lenz, who's been with Laugh Staff since the beginning, says some of their past shows have been on smaller stages at the Center for the Arts.
We're excited to be on the main stage. We haven't done a big main stage show ever.
Over the years, the group has built a consistent following. More often than not, their shows sell out. Len says they've watched their audience grow up too.
I remember one show we gave autographs to a couple kids and signed their ball caps. And now they're, I think, out of college.
The group formed out of an improv class and has been joking together since. Founding member Nick Sterin remembers the moment it clicked.
All of us looked around and were like, we're pretty good. We should start performing. So
very humble.
We're very humble. Way humble. Handsome and humble. And we did. We started that winter.
The majority of the troupe's current members joined early on and have stuck with it throughout the years. Nick's twin brother Chris says the crew has been through a lot together.
There can be days when you're embarrassed about something that happened at work or some tragedy that happens, and you can come together and you can throw it out there and we can have fun with it.
Improv comedy is all about making it up on the fly. Chris says it's healing.
Being an adult can be kind of lonely, and so this is a great way to be silly. It's rare as an adult to be silly, and it's so good for the soul.
Take, for example, the rhyming game, Do Ron Ron.
Do Ron Ron Ron, the Do Ron Ron. I asked her to go out and I gave her my pen. Do Ron Ron Ron, the Do Ron.
Everyone has to come up with a new rhyme in turn, all while singing and staying on beat. And if you repeat a rhyme, well, you're out.
She drank whites in.
If not now, but when?
She never knew how to win.
It's clear the troupe has improv together for years. They make fun of each other like siblings throughout rehearsal. But for two members, Laughstaff has literally become their family.
I'm Kira Strom Griffith. I got involved with the Laughstaff by selling beer and volunteering, and so they called me the beer wench.
Eventually, the troupe started inviting Strom Griffith up on stage to jump into scenes. Before long, she was a full-fledged member. At practice, she met Josh.
I'm kind of an awkward guy. You need to have a good sense of humor to hang out with me, I guess. And Kira does have a good sense of humor, and she's just a very genuine laugher.
The two started clicking, on and off stage. Now, they're married and have two kids. For Josh, performing with Kira is one big metaphor for partnership.
We get to have these big ups and downs together on stage and then talk about them afterward and like sharing in each other's joys and sharing in each other's kind of failures, I guess.
Kira says that kind of connection and community is true of the whole Laughstaff family.
One of the last things we all say to each other right before we step on stage is, I've got your back, and we all tap each other's backs.
One of the people they tap on the back is Roan Eastman. Eastman is the troupe's newest member and is a teacher at the local high school. He joined right before the pandemic to push himself out of his comfort zone.
My wife, who knows me well enough to know how to manipulate me, said, bet you won't do it. And so here we are.
Eastman has a big, bushy beard and looks like he'd be right at home on a motorcycle. He'd never done improv before joining and immediately fell in love with it. For him, it's a type of meditation.
I'm someone who spends a fair amount of time in my own head, and you can't think doing improv. If you think, then it ends up being dumb, and so it's just reacting.
Eastman loved being in theater and musicals as a kid, but anxiety around remembering his lines made him stop. Thanks to the unscriptedness of improv, he's now able to get back in touch with that part of himself.
I guess the biggest surprise was that people aren't as scary as we make them out to be. And improv definitely makes you comfortable with failing.
Do run, 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 do run, run, do, do. He wasn't Richard, he was Dick.
And that's all they hope for on their 15th anniversary, that people will come and laugh. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Another group in Jackson is bringing people together. Country swing is king in Wyoming. The Wild West vibe attracts tourists and locals for live music and nights of dancing. But there's another style of dance that's taking Jackson Hole by storm and helping bring different communities together. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Hannah Merzbach gets a lesson at Latin Dance Night.
1, 2, 3, tap, 5, 6, 7, tap.
About 3 dozen people are spaced out in the Center for the Arts lobby.
And for some music.
Getting an informal lesson from Stephen Belitas.
Make a big tap to make it really noticeable.
Belitas is teaching them bachata, a style of Latin dance he picked up while living in Argentina. It's slower than salsa and easier to learn. He tells the group to partner up and grab each other's hands.
And this is good tension. Good tension, you can feel. So we're never gonna grab onto anybody like they do in country swing dancing and break their arms and elbows.
For over 15 years, the Latin dance community has been blossoming with classes like this and pop-up events in Jackson and Teton Valley, Idaho.
There was no Cuban dancing. There was no salsa dancing. So we said, why don't we do it?
Jake and Ordia Hodge started the Strictly Salsa program, which grew to also include bachata, after they moved to town in 2008. The couple had danced Cuban salsa with top performers in places like San Francisco and Miami, and brought them as teachers to the dancers' workshop. Ordia Hodge, who's French, says about 80% of the people they know in the Jackson area are through this community.
We had so many people come and dance, and it was just so exciting to see, you know, the West really taking to Latin dancing and Cuban salsa in particular.
What makes Cuban salsa unique? Jake Hodge says an arrangement called a rueda, where dancers pair up and get in a circle, and someone calls out each move as they transfer partners.
The integration, the unity, the excitement, the community that you feel in that rueda, I think is the thing that separates it from any other dance done around here right now.
Lesson time is now over, and dozens more people have filled the lobby for a night of social dancing. Carly Ann Edwards is standing on the side talking to some friends. She took a beginner salsa workshop last spring, which she says inspired her.
I actually just went to Cuba for Thanksgiving to do some salsa dancing with two of my close friends.
Now, Edwards is retaking the level one class to learn how to lead. She says there's not that many art opportunities in Jackson, so she likes to take advantage of all of them, whether that's theater or dancing, and says salsa has opened her up to a whole other community.
I've had people that I've known as acquaintances, and then I see them in a salsa class and we become closer friends, or I've seen my neighbor's babysitter in a salsa class and able just to further connections and build connections within the community.
She walks up to someone from her workshop last spring and asks them to dance.
Would you want to dance?
Sure.
Do you remember we were in class
together
this spring?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, good to see you.
Good to see you.
And they're off, spinning around the dance floor. Meanwhile, Juan Morales, a dancer and teacher, leans up against the bar. He has a black and orange poncho called a gabon draped around his shoulders.
Keeps me warm, and I'm very proud of my heritage.
Morales is Mexican-American and grew up in Jackson. And he says it took time to get many in the Latino community to come out dancing.
As we started years ago, it's mainly Anglo, but now if you look around the room, there's Latino, there's Central South American, obviously still very much Anglo, some French, of course.
But he says they're still working to get more people in the community to come out. Strictly Salsa co-founder Jake Hodge says they're trying to make it as inclusive as possible for all kinds of dance backgrounds.
A lot of Mexican people dance cumbia. We play cumbia music and they get up and love to dance the cumbia. It's exciting to see that everybody's mixing together.
Before the night wraps up, Juan Morales takes me for a spin. I've done some salsa, but I'm new to bachata.
What are you doing with your hips?
So with my hips, you want to sway them left and right, or back and forth, or out and in. You got to let the hips do the hips.
So it's kind of the same as salsa.
Yeah, same as salsa, just on a different count, different speed. And yeah, the steps are a little bit different. So okay, salsa's back and forth, this is side to side. And then I'm going to dip you gently, ever so gently this way. And we dip and we do, and that's it. Woo!
And with that, I'm hooked and definitely will be back. Latin dance nights are free for anyone and take place monthly at the Center for the Arts in Jackson. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach in Jackson.
Polarizing politics and Wyoming Public Radio's effort to reach out to our listeners. That's up next on Open Spaces.
Did you know that all six episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
the story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Cheyenne Roundup is back for the 67th Legislature's budget session. Join Wyoming Public Media and Wildfowl Reporters for a weekly look at the problem-solving and power struggles at Wyoming State House. Every Monday of the session, starting February 12th, we'll preview the legislative week ahead, what bills have died, and what's still kicking. Find it wherever you get your podcast or tune in to Wyoming Public Radio on Monday afternoons or Tuesday mornings. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Camila Kadelska. Have you noticed local issues taking a back seat to much bigger national debates? There's a name for that. It's called nationalized politics, a trend seen in voters and politicians alike, where the focus starts in Washington and trickles back to your town hall. That's the topic of a new book co-authored by University of Wyoming professor Ryan Williamson. Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger sat down with Williamson to discuss what exactly nationalized politics looks like in Wyoming and across America.
Right, so when we talk about nationalized politics, we're talking about people caring more about which party is in power and less about who represents them in their specific district or state. And so local issues take a backseat to national issues. These top-down forces like presidential elections and the issues that they focus on. When we talk about nationalization, those are the things that dominate politics during these highly nationalized eras, like we're seeing now and like we saw in the 1800s. The difference is in the 1800s, a lot of this nationalization was a function of electoral rules. We had a party ballot where you couldn't vote for candidates from different parties. You functionally just supported the party's slate of candidates, or you didn't vote at all. Now, about 100 years later, we're seeing a resurgence in nationalization, but it's not a function of electoral rules. We see people consciously making a decision to support the party's slate of candidates. They're not splitting their tickets. They're not thinking about localized issues. They just care about getting their preferred candidate into the White House and voting for as many people as possible who will support that same agenda.
So for a Wyoming voter, their concern with the federal government's involvement in the expansion of broadband in the state versus their concern with if their local representative is going to support the presidential candidate that they like or not. Which one of these is a nationalized politics?
For sake of example, we'll say Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, and that's who people in the state are generally supportive of. It's going to be much more likely that someone's going to say, I'm supporting Trump, Trump's policies, and people who will also support Trump's policies. It's much less likely, not impossible now, but much less likely that a voter is going to fixate on something like the federal government's relationship to the expansion of rural broadband within the state. Wyoming is actually one of the best examples for kind of how nationalized politics have played out. You know, you have Liz Cheney, who, you know, by all measures, very conservative Republican, had been a really good kind of bearer of the Republican Party brand for a long time. But in defiance of Trump with the January 6th committee, you see that fracture. You see that idea of her not being Republican enough. And so candidates who are willing to be quote unquote Republican enough or Democratic enough are going to fare a lot better than someone who's trying to make some high-minded, nuanced arguments about, you know, both parties have good ideas that should be pursued. That's just, we don't live in a time where that's going to be very productive or successful.
I wonder if top-down politics is leaving room for a grassroots third-party movement to cover overlooked local issues, or will candidates just need to assimilate into a national party if they want to get anything effective done?
Unfortunately, I fear it's the latter. I think candidates will just have to kind of toe the party line on these national issues. That is kind of the easiest way to demonstrate to voters that you are a good Republican or a good Democrat worthy of support. And to the question of, you know, is this leaving room for a localized grassroots third party to emerge? You know, the Democratic Party is the oldest political party on the planet, and the Republican Party isn't that far behind. And one of the ways that they've been able to exist for this tremendously long time is by evolving. And one of the things that they do in the event that something like a third party in a district, a state, or even the entire country, if one were to emerge, one of the parties will look at the platform, think about some key planks that they can then bring over into their platform, and therefore kind of take the wind out of the sails of any third party movement. And so the parties were designed in such a way to kind of ensure that these third parties don't emerge. You know, one of the unique characteristics about American politics is we build our coalitions on the front end. In other countries, you know, you have in a parliamentary system, you know, two, three, four different parties have to come together in order to form a majority coalition. We do a lot of that on the front end. Like only in American politics, really, can you see someone like Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts exist in the same party, in the same chamber, at the same point in time. In another country, they would be from different parties and then might govern together temporarily under a coalition-style government.
So has there ever been a time in American politics where American voters really were part of an active party apparatus or really had to, on a national level, work to form like in other countries, a coalition government?
You know, there was a time where people consciously voted for Democrats in Congress and Republicans for the White House. This idea that Republicans were good on foreign policy and the economy, but Democrats were good at providing localized benefits to districts. They were good at, you know, ensuring a safety net. And people liked the idea that the parties had to engage in competition and cooperation in order to realize policy goals. That's not really the case anymore.
So it feels like we're all very used to this kind of, like, when something happens nationally, that's when we rally. If it happens at home, hey, you know, talk to your local politicians and hope they're also Democrats or Republicans. Has it already happened? Has politics already been nationalized, or are we on the front end of this and it's only going to get more and more so?
I think we are smack in the middle of this highly nationalized era, and I think it could become even more pronounced before it ultimately subsides, if it ultimately subsides. But there are limits to that. You know, at the end of the day, people still want good people to represent them who pursue policies that are relevant to them. And so it remains to be seen, I think, how far we can go with nationalization before voters start responding to something else.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Jordan Uplinger speaking with University of Wyoming professor Ryan Williamson on his new book, Nationalized Politics: Evaluating Electoral Politics Across Time. In an effort to focus on Wyoming politics, Wyoming Public Radio wants to hear from you, our listeners, about the upcoming election. We've partnered with the team at America Amplified to ensure that you have the information you need to participate in the general election in November. As part of that partnership, we will be launching a tool on our website to answer your questions. Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Ingalls spoke with Alisa Barba, America Amplified's managing director, about the project and the new tool.
Well, there's kind of two goals. One, America Amplified has been around since 2019. We are a corporation for public broadcasting funded initiative to support community engagement journalism in public media. And so that means we are helping public media stations, many spread around the country, to better engage with their communities, to have a better sense of who their communities are and what their information needs are, to be a public service journalism operation. So that's number one. we just launched an election 2024 initiative, which is more directly focused on the upcoming election. We have some 57 stations across the country reaching audiences in all 50 states to ensure that their communities have the information they need to confidently participate in the upcoming election. So on a very narrow focus, what do you need to know about how to cast your vote? Not who to cast your vote for, but how to cast your vote, how to actually go through the process of casting a ballot.
And as part of that election initiative, there's the Harkin Embed or Harkin tool that public radio stations are able to use. Can you kind of tell me a little bit about how it works?
Yeah, Harkin, again, is just an engagement tool. It's a way to basically prompt questions from your audience and your community. And it is a web-based embed or a call out that goes on your website at its bare minimum that basically says, has a prompt in it. What questions do you have about participating in the upcoming election? And you as an audience member can say, where can I get my absentee ballot? You put that question in, you give us your name, your email, and your zip code, and then we will work to answer that question.
Okay, yeah. And I know it uses AI for part of the information gathering. Can you kind of speak to why you chose to use AI and kind of how that factors into everything?
Okay, Harkin doesn't use AI. Harkin just receives the questions. But we're working, as I said, with stations all around the country. And we're not just giving them the question prompt, we're also helping them in answering the questions. So if we're going to be answering questions about elections in 50 some states, we're going to need a little bit of help. And that's where AI comes in. So most of the information that you're going to need to figure out how to vote is available usually on your Secretary of State's website or whoever in your state regulates the election process. So what we did is working with a database and analysis company, we set up a database where we used generative AI to scrape those Secretary of State websites for all the information, officially verified information we may need to answer questions in all 50 states. You know, we have a full-time staff of five, and then we have two other people that we are calling our engagement support staff. And they are the people who are kind of behind the curtains, as it were, as questions come in from Wyoming or wherever in the country about the voting process. It gets fed into this Harkin engagement management system and then is sent over to that database that I just talked about. The database will scrape the information from the Wyoming Secretary of State's website and will spit out an answer. And then we have a human being who will be looking at that answer, and then that answer will go back to the person who sent in the question. So the AI is what helps us gather the information for the database to answer the questions.
Okay, that makes sense. So, I mean, it seems like there's quite a bit of human involvement in it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So our engagement staff will, verify the source, translate the language, and then also send it to the news director or the reporter at the station in that state to say, here's the answer we came up with. Does that look okay? And that needs a thumbs up from that station as well. Eventually, after you've received three or four or five really good, relevant questions, we will create an FAQ that you can produce for your website and for your audience.
How does this benefit the public and our listeners? What are they getting out of it?
Well, they're getting an easy way to get the information that they need about the election. I mean, you know, many of us, especially in the journalism world, we know like, what's the deadline for sending in my absentee ballot? And we may sit down and talk to Google about that. This is a way they know they can come to you for those answers. You'll do the work and make it easy for them.
Right. Okay. I know there was a pilot program of this project. Can you speak a little bit about that and kind of what you've learned or changed since then to benefit this iteration of the project?
Yeah. So we did a pilot project for the midterm elections in 2022. We were working with 30 stations across 25 states. Similar project. We provided them with a Harkin embed. One of the big differences that that project began in May and the election was in November. This project began a year earlier, right? A year before the election, because to really build trust with your audience and your community, you have to start earlier and you really have to go out and be there and be in front of them. It's not just an election project. It's really about a long-term relationship that you're developing with your audience. What we learned was that a lot of public radio listeners don't have a lot of questions about how to vote. It's a voting population for the most part. They pretty much have that down. They did have questions about judicial candidates in many places, you know, like how do I decide which judges to vote for? Because there's usually not a lot of information about that. And we also just recognize that we need to be available to answer all kinds of questions that come in, whether they be about voting processes or about issues. If a question comes in, something that was very particular to Wyoming, or maybe even very particular to a community in Wyoming, like Cheyenne or someplace like that, that you all would be able to step in and provide an answer to that question so that that listener, that audience member, recognizes that he or she is being heard. And they're not just sending this question off into the void.
That kind of leads to my other question of, if someone submits a question that's not just a factual, you know, what date do I need to get this in for? That's okay. And we will still work to answer that. And the team with Harkin will work with Wyoming Public Radio to answer that, correct?
Absolutely. That is definitely our goal. This year, we're really trying to step it up a little bit and be much more responsive. But it's also on stations like you all to do that too. We want to take a lot of the work away from you, but in the end, if to answer those questions, it's going to come back to you all.
All right, perfect. Well, thank you for speaking with me.
No problem. Thanks, Ivy.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Ivy Engel speaking to Alisa Barba, the Managing Director of America Amplified, about our new project. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcasts. And we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our producer and digital producer. And thank you to Eric Vigil, our social media manager, for today's show. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.